MacCast, Wednesday, July 15th, 2015. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, we got a nice show for you today. It's a little bit, probably lighter than the last few shows that we've been having. News seems to be dying down a little bit, and that happens around the summertime. We get into this little bit of lull, not a whole bunch of stuff happening. Now, one exciting thing did happen this week, and of course, we're going to get into that, some updates to one of Apple's product lineups. But mostly, we're waiting around to see what happens with new iPhones. So we've got iPhone rumors in here. We're going to talk a little bit about Apple Watch stuff. Also, Apple doing some interesting things with regard to Apple Music. And, of course, some rumors on new product coming out, as well as something exciting happening over there in the UK. And then we're going to get into some of your feedback, again talking a little bit more about Apple Music. That's a big thing that a lot of us are getting into and playing around with and wondering about. Also, I have somebody who wants to move from Android to iOS and could use our help. Got a little mail tip here in here for you, and also my thing of the moment. So we're going to get into all of that here in just a minute. But before we get started, I do want to take a moment and thank one of my show sponsors, actually a new sponsor here on the MacCast, and that is Bushel. And you're really going to like this. This is really cool. Bushel is a service. You know, some people are IT people, but not by choice, right? It ends up being this task that we do, not our career, right? You're probably in this group. If you're listening to this podcast, you're probably this person for your family. And it doesn't happen just in your family, though. It can also happen at the office, right? You're hired to do one thing. A bunch of people find out that you're actually really good at computers. And suddenly, guess what? You're the de facto IT person. It happens a lot at small, medium-sized offices. I guess it could happen at big offices as well. This happened to me when I was living in Oregon. I worked for an advertising agency. They didn't have an IT person. They found out I knew a lot about Macs, and boom, I'm suddenly doing a lot of IT tasks. Well, Bushel is perfect for these types of people because it is a simple-to-use cloud-based tool that lets you manage Apple devices. And you can do it in the workplace. I think you could also do it at home because it has great features like the ability to do your device inventory, so keep track of all your Apple devices that you have deployed. You can do app distribution. So if you need to push out app packages and applications to all of the devices at once, push out updates, lets you do that. Streamlined enrollment. How about setting up Wi-Fi and email settings? Can you imagine? You've got a bunch of devices that you need to deploy. You don't want to have to go in and do that one by one on each device. It'll take forever. Let Bushel do that for you. Also, security functionality. What happens if a device is stolen or lost? You need to be able to remote wipe and lock those things. Disk encryption to protect sensitive data. All those sorts of things Bushel can help you out with. And what's great is they make it really simple. A lot of other tools require a big background, IT knowledge, all that sort of stuff. Bushel was designed from the ground up to be made simple and intuitive. It's supposed to be there so anyone in the office can use it and you don't have to take a lot of time to figure it out. So really powerful, but also really simple and easy to use. And because it's in the cloud, that means you can use it from anywhere with any devices. They have great affordable pricing. Actually starts at free, so you can get on board. And that's what I want you to do. I want you to check out Bushel. You can get it free for up to 3 devices when you sign up at bushel.com/MacCast. And this isn't a trial. You actually can get 3 devices free for forever. So you can check it out, see if it's something you can use. I really think, you know, like looking at it thinking, I should probably be using this with my family because I can manage their devices. I'm doing that anyway. Now I can do it remotely through a web interface. It sounds perfect. So check it out, bushel.com/MacCast, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So I'm not going to bury the lead this week. The big, big news just happened today. I'm recording this on Wednesday. Apple dropped new iPods on us. We had heard the rumors that this was going to happen. Updates to all three models, the Shuffles, the Nanos, and the iPod Touch. All three of them received new updated colors. Actually, the three new colors that surfaced were tipped off via some images that were discovered in the update to iTunes, the most recent update to iTunes, iTunes 12.2. I can't remember if we talked about this or not. There was a new darker blue color, a gold color. Some people were calling it beige, but it, you know, it's like the typical Apple gold, and a brighter pink color. There was a little image that was found in the resources for iTunes 12.2, and everybody thought, oh, we've got new iPods coming. These colors are in addition to the current silver and space gray options, as well as the product red options. So you got six color choices, again, available across the board, and the same with the Shuffles, the Nanos, and the iPod Touch. And the new colors were actually the extent of the updates to the Nano and the Shuffle. Their sizing and prices are exactly the same, so they just get the new color treatment. The Shuffle, you're going to get 2 gigabytes of storage for $99 US, and with the Nano, it's the 16 gigabytes of storage, and that runs US $149. So not a lot of new stuff with those two models, but the now sixth generation iPod Touch is finally come up to speed with basically the latest iPhone specs. It's pretty much coming in line with the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus. This is actually the first major update to the iPod Touch line since I think around 2012, so this is a pretty big deal. The new model has a 64-bit A8 processor, so the same processor that is in the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus. That also comes with the M8 motion coprocessor, so you're going to be able to do your motion tracking, your exercise and health stuff with this new iPod Touch. Also an 8-megapixel rear camera, so much better camera on the updated model. Support for 802.11 AC Wi-Fi, so latest Wi-Fi technologies. And actually, it has one feature that is better than what is in the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus, and that is the newest version of Bluetooth, Bluetooth 4.1, and this is the first Apple device to have that. The other thing that they added was more storage. There's now a 128 gigabyte option on the high end. So I think this is really great, especially considering the fact that Apple, I think just late last year, discontinued the iPod Classic. So that was the 160 gigabyte iPod. Those of you who wanted to have all of your music synced over to a device, that was the solution for a lot of people. And when Apple discontinued that, you really only had the 64 gigabyte iPod Touch. So now we have 128 gigabyte option. You're going to be able to get a lot of music and audio and media on there. And as far as the performance, TechCrunch actually already went out, got a hold of one of the new iPod Touches, ran some Geekbench numbers on it just to see how that new A8 processor panned out. And it looks like it's clocked just slightly lower than the one in the iPhone 6. Their testing showed that it's probably clocked at 1.1 gigahertz. The iPhone 6 processor runs at about 1.39, 1.4 gigahertz. And it's believed they maybe clocked it down a little bit to eke a little bit more out of the battery life, because it still is the same size. The actual physical design of the iPod Touch, other than the colors, really remained unchanged. So it's 6.1 millimeters thick with a 4-inch Retina display. So it didn't get the bump up in size like the iPhone 6, and therefore a little less battery. So they probably clocked the processor down to make sure that the battery life stayed up there. But you do have four storage options, a 16 gigabyte model starting at $199 US. Then you jump to $249 for the 32 gigabyte, $299 for the 64 gigabyte. And then if you want the new 128 gigabyte configuration in the iPod Touch, it's going to run you $399. So a little bit pricey, but still a really nice update to the iPod lineup. About the only thing that was interesting about this is I am starting to wonder, where does the iPod Nano fit in this configuration? Because it's at 16 gigabytes. I know it's a little bit smaller size than the iPod Touch, but for about $50 more, you could pick up an iPod Touch. You're going to have a lot more functionality. You're going to have that A8 processor, the M8 Motion coprocessor, 8 megapixel Wi-Fi or camera. You've got the Wi-Fi and the Bluetooth in there. It just seems like that is a lot of stuff for that extra $50. I guess if you really need a small portable iPod and you want a screen on it, then the Nano is still your option, and it's nice that they have that choice there. But just looking at the lineup, it seems a little bit odd, and I was surprised they actually didn't just phase out the Nano. I get why the Shuffle is there. It's that thing you can clip on, take to the gym, that sort of thing. It's only $100. So that seems to make a little more sense to me. But I do think because Apple is, this is sort of the iPod lineup, and you can see they've really slimmed it down in terms of the options. I think we can kind of see iPod sales have been declining for the years. A lot of people are moving over to iPhones. I think between the iPhone and the iPod Touch, I think those will be around for a while. But I kind of question, what's the longevity of the Shuffle and the Nano at this point? Wouldn't surprise me if in the next year or two, Apple actually phases those lines out and just goes with the iPod Touch and iPhone as the options. But another big advantage for the iPod Touch versus some of the other updated iPods is support for Apple Music. And this was another thing that surprised me. I thought when Apple updated the Shuffle and the Nano, they would announce that they were adding support for the new Apple Music format, so that you can, with Apple Music, you could download and do offline listening of your music. But it turns out you can't sync those over to iPods other than the fifth generation iPod Touch and now the sixth generation iPod Touch. So it's really odd. And I can't figure out what the difference is either. I've been doing a little investigating and poking around, and what I found odd is that the tracks that are Apple Music tracks in iTunes 12, so the ones that you would download for offline listening in iTunes, if you pull up the Get Info window on those tracks and look at the information, it says that they have Apple FairPlay version 2 DRM applied to them. Well, that's the current version of FairPlay that does work on older iPod Nanos and Shuffles. So I'm not really sure what's different about that format that causes it to be incompatible with the older iPods, and I'd be curious to find that out. So I'm gonna continue to do a little bit of investigating on this. I've been asking around with some of my sources, so hopefully something will come out of it. I'm sure we're gonna find it's something related to the licensing and the deals that Apple put in place with the music industry to actually be able to get Apple Music out the door. But I'm hoping at some point that they'll be able to do some sort of software update for the iPods, specifically the Nano and the Shuffle, to allow Apple Music to go on there. I think it makes sense. I think it's something Apple probably wants to do, and there's just been some hurdles or some roadblocks in getting that to happen. But that's the latest updates on the iPod lineup, and it was nice to see them, actually getting some updates this week. Some people are finding the Apple Watch to be irritating, and I'm not just talking about Android fanboys. We've had actually some various reports over the past couple weeks of Apple Watch owners developing rashes from the watch band. And while this seems extreme at first, and some of the media was reporting it, in a negative Apple light, as they will want to do, sort of, something to bash the Apple Watch with. This is really not an issue specifically with the materials in the Apple Watch or the Apple Watch itself, not something that's exclusive to the Apple Watch. We've seen this with other fitness bands. We've seen this with other smartwatches and actually just watches in general. I think actually part of the reason this stuff is surfacing is many of us haven't worn watches in a really long time, right? They've been sort of out of fashion. And now that people are starting to wear a watch again, you start to have just possible causes of skin irritations. Any band worn on the wrist could possibly cause or develop a rash. There's lots of reasons why this might happen. Could be simply friction of the band moving back and forth. Maybe it's just not snug enough. You have contact dermatitis from dirt or soap or water or other irritants getting stuck beneath the band. Maybe you've just been working with some chemicals, cleaning products, and it gets under there and starts to irritate your skin because it's just pressed in there. Allergic reactions to some of the adhesives or the nickel used in the Apple Watch's production. As a matter of fact, Apple's own documentation notes that there are rare instances when some users could experience this kind of reaction, and they specifically call out reactions to some of the adhesives and nickel material that they use during the production of the watch. Some people are sensitive to that, and you could get one of these rashes. So if you are experiencing this sort of thing, definitely you're going to want to take your Apple Watch off for a while, see if the irritation goes away, and maybe if it, and then if it does, try it on again. If the problems continue, you probably want to, you know, consult a physician or check with your doctor and see what's going on there. But this isn't a serious thing. This isn't, you know, anything that's rampant. It's just something that surfaced online this week. And I wanted to bring up because, you know, some people were sort of panicking and you know, pointing the finger at Apple. And that's definitely what we don't want to do. And those of you who are Kiwis, New Zealanders, will soon be able to be irritated by the Apple Watch band if you'd like as well. I think actually some people will really welcome the opportunity to see if they're going to have a reaction. You guys have been waiting on the Apple Watch, and the Apple App Store app for iOS was updated this week, showing that New Zealand is going to get the Apple Watch on July 31st. Customers in New Zealand will be able to purchase the Apple Watch starting at 7:01 a.m. local time. I think that's actually earlier than we've been able to get it when it went on sale here in the States. I think we had to wait all the way till 8 a.m. So you're going to get it a full 59 minutes earlier in the day. So that's pretty cool. But you'll be able to pick up your Apple Watch. No word if there's going to be rollout in any other countries. I think we've just seen New Zealand at this point. Apple has been steadily rolling out the Apple Watch to more and more countries. So I guess stay tuned to the website, you know, the Apple Watch website for your region, or maybe the Apple Watch app to find out when you can get an Apple Watch if it hasn't surfaced in your location yet. But good news for New Zealand. The Apple Watch is coming before the end of the month. What do you think about the concept of Apple Music Television, Apple MTV? Well, this isn't a new channel that's showing up on your Apple TV box, but it's something interesting that happened this week. Some people believe that Apple has begun producing music videos for some artists and are actually releasing them via the Apple Music Connect program. This is the social part of Apple Music, and there's been these videos that have been showing up there first. This is according to Pitchfork, which is a music, I think, blog and publication. Apple's production team reportedly created videos for Freedom, which is a track from Pharrell, also Eminem's Phenomenal and Drake's Energy, and all of them debuted as Apple Music exclusives. Actually, the Eminem video prominently featured an Apple Watch, an iPhone 6, and even Dr. Dre, who is one of the people, you know, he's from Beats, so he's responsible for Apple Music. So I think the tie-ins are there. And I think even in one of the videos I was watching, I can't remember if it was the Freedom or the Phenomenal video, or excuse me, Drake's Energy video, the bird shot from the Shot on iPhone ads, I think, was in there. You know, they kind of have the swarm of blackbirds. I think almost that exact image was in there. So I think there's lots of hints to indicate that Apple has been producing these videos. And Pitchfork also says that Purity Ring, Diddy, and James Bay, as well as some other artists, are working with Apple to, again, produce content and bring videos to Apple Music. And I was reading somewhere, too, that videos have been very popular on the Apple Music service. I didn't, you know, I grew up in the era of MTV when we actually had music videos on MTV, and it was a big thing. And I know they've been kind of popular on YouTube recently, but I never thought that, you know, Apple Music would be a big part of the whole music video scene. But I guess that's turning out to be the case, and Apple is helping some of their artists and the people that they want to help promote on Apple Music put those things together. So Apple, you know, I thought Apple might get into video production at some point, maybe producing exclusive content or original content for the Apple TV, the set-top box, but it looks like maybe they're dipping their toe in by doing this music video thing, and that's pretty interesting. And speaking of Apple Music and iTunes, Apple did release the first update for iTunes 12.2 this week. iTunes 12.2.1 actually fixes some issues with iTunes Match, where iTunes incorrectly changed some songs from Match to Apple Music. So that was the whole applying the DRM thing. I didn't think that was actually really happening. I think we talked about this on the last episode. I thought it was just more of a visual thing, but this update obviously indicates that some people were having some issues. It provides a way to correct a library problem that affected former iTunes Match subscribers. I think that was some of the mismatched metadata and issues people were having. So it hopefully fixes that up, and also included some minor bug fixes as well as improvements for Apple's Beats One radio station. So if you've been having these kinds of issues with iTunes, you probably want to make sure you grab this latest update. So just run your software update from iTunes or from the App Store, the Mac App Store app. And on the real television side, there are rumors that Apple is still trying to make its Apple TV streaming service happen. The New York Post claims that Apple has been in talks with ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox. Those are still ongoing. We've been hearing about those for a while. But the new news is that those talks and negotiations might get sped up here pretty soon, because one of the issues has been that when Apple does negotiations, it's not just with the networks. They also have to deal with the network affiliates, especially if they want to get local live TV content. So, you know, like your local news and things like that. And that reportedly is part of the service package that Apple wants to put together. But the problem there would be that Apple would have to go out and negotiate independently with all of these affiliates, and that could take a really, really long time. Well, now, according to the New York Post sources, they say that the networks are very close to getting the rights to actually negotiate with Apple on the behalf of the affiliates. So that would greatly ease the process. Apple could just deal directly with the networks. And I guess each network is having to work this out with their affiliates, but that seems to be the route that they're going. And that means the streaming music service could actually become a thing here pretty soon. The rumors have been that Apple wants to launch a new service where they'd have certain channels that were available through your Apple TV for a monthly subscription charge. It's looking like they're targeting a price range between $30 to $40 a month, or that's at least what we had been hearing. In the New York Post report, they say Apple may have pricing starting as low as $10 a month. So that's a little bit wider range than we had heard before. I'm not sure how reliable the New York Post is as a news source for Apple News, but it's still an interesting story to talk about. And Apple's been targeting trying to actually get the streaming service up and running by the fall. They usually have a big iPod, you know, media event around the fall time frame. It's also when we would expect them to be announcing new iPhones and all those sorts of things. So the timing would make sense for that Apple would want to, you know, launch it then. And then, depending on how things go, you know, that's going to determine what content is there. We've been hearing for a while that at the very least they would be able to launch with probably some limited content from Disney, which is ABC, which Apple's always had a really good relationship with, and possibly CBS at this point, trying to get more in the offering. I'm sure they want to get as many of these deals done as they can. And so hopefully with this new affiliate thing happening, they'll be able to do a lot more of that. But as far as how the service is, the Post says their source told them that the platform is totally ready to go. So Apple has all the infrastructure in place. It just needs to get the content together. And they say that the platform, quote unquote, rocks. So that would be great, but it's not going to rock very hard if Apple doesn't get the content to go with the platform. So we'll just have to wait and see. I'm curious, are you excited about the concept of Apple doing direct streaming television? I'd be interested in it again if they can get some of the local live TV content, specifically my local news and stuff like that, because being a cord cutter, I really don't have access to a lot of that. I mean, I get some of it through following my local news agencies on Twitter, maybe popping online to their websites once in a while, but it'd be nice to have that right there and available on my Apple TV. Also, some of the just network TV shows, although I've been picking up a lot of that just through their individual apps. So I don't know how much different that would really be for me. I guess it's going to come down to pricing and what kind of content is on there, whether I get more excited about this or not. And we're really not going to know that until Apple makes some sort of official announcement. So just gonna have to wait on this one. This next story is some facts and figures that get brought up every once in a while, but I have to admit that every time I read this report, I'm more and more fascinated by it. And it is about the relationship between Apple's share of the smartphone market, just in terms of the units that they sell versus the amount of profit share that they get. So Canaccord Genuity is out with their latest estimates, and they say that Apple is now taking about 92% of the smartphone industry profits. And that's despite only having 20% of the global smartphone market share. So they have 20% of the market share, but get 92% of the profit. And that's up from 65% of the industry profits last year. So that is a huge increase. And I don't know if that's just because of this. I would assume a lot of that is because of the success of the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus. What the sort of profit margins are that Apple has built into that. And, Apple is able to achieve this amazing stat because I think, they're able to keep their pricing up and compete mostly on the high side, the premium side of the market. They're not down in that low cost range where there's very little margin and very little profit. And as a matter of fact, a recent Strategy Analytics report states that the average selling price of an iPhone globally in 2014 was $624. This is in US dollars, whereas devices running Android on average sold at $185. So what's that's almost, more than three times the average selling price. So when you look at it that way, it kind of makes sense that Apple would have that much of a percentage of the profits versus their market share. Now, one thing I do want to mention as we're talking about these numbers is that the Canaccord report does not factor in a couple of privately held companies who are pretty big players in the market. Specifically, and I think you pronounce it Xiaomi, the manufacturer of smartphones in China that are really, really popular. China's a huge market, and India's Micro Max. Those are not included in here because those are both privately held companies. But they also both play on the really low end of the market. So it's not believed that, they would be much of a factor in terms of the smartphone profit share numbers. So again, fascinating every time I hear this, how much of the smartphone profit Apple makes versus how much of the market share they actually own. We've been talking about iPad Pro rumors for, man, it seems like a couple years now. That's probably actually pretty accurate. We started hearing that Apple was maybe working on a new larger size device, something that would possibly have a touch screen, maybe pressure sensitivity, maybe even an Apple designed stylus. All that stuff still floating around out there, but we never really had a time frame for when we might see it. Well, a report from DigiTimes this week says that the iPad Pros may arrive in December. Now, as far as what the final specifications might look like, again, we're only speculating, but rumor has it it's going to be a 12.9-inch screen with a 2732 by 2048 resolution. Stereo speakers, so it's going to have, I think, two speakers on each side for a total of four speakers on either end of the iPad. As a matter of fact, iOS 9 had some indications of what might you know, what an iPad Pro might look like. There has been some special keyboard layouts that seem to only become available when the resolution in the iOS simulator is put into that, you know, 12.9 inch screen range. And then when you do that, iOS 9 seems to be displaying an extra row of number keys as well as additional function keys. So it's looking like this is going to be a size, form factor, and a thing. Apple Insider's sources indicated back in May that Apple was indeed working on a larger iPad and that it would include this new, all-new Bluetooth stylus accessory that would have pressure sensitivity. It's sounding like that's not going to be a stock option in the iPad Pro or something that comes with it, more that it's going to be an accessory that's announced alongside the iPad Pro. Some of the other rumors we had been hearing, Force Touch input, NFC functionality, not so much for doing Apple Pay payments, but for actually becoming an Apple Pay terminal. So a lot of people use iPads as, you know, like cash registers. So you'd have built-in functionality to be able to accept Apple Pay payments. And Apple moving from the Lightning connector finally on the iPad Pro to the newer USB-C connection like they have in the latest MacBook. And I think that would make a lot of sense. I fully expect that the next generation of iPhones and iPads could all have a USB-C connection with Apple standardizing on that port. But really, the belief is that Apple is looking to bring some energy into declining iPad sales. iPad sales have been flat and sort of slowly going down over the last couple quarters. If you listen into Apple's quarterly results calls, it's usually something the analysts kind of pick at Apple for a little bit. Tim Cook has always sort of defended the business, and I think rightfully so. I think the iPad is just exactly what it is, and a lot of people have used it as a laptop supplement or a laptop replacement, and it's just not the kind of device where you're going to be necessarily buying a new one every year unless you're a freak like me and, you know, have a business reason to do it. But the average user is going to buy an iPad. It's going to work for them. They're a good, robust system, and they just don't get swapped out all that frequently. So the thought is by bringing out this new sort of Pro model, it'll reinvigorate, you know, re-excite people, specifically in the business and the enterprise market, also more the power users, designers, those sorts of folks. I don't really know. I am a web designer and developer, and I guess I'd really have to see sort of how some of the stylus functionality works, pressure sensitivity, those sorts of things. Certainly with Apple doing the split screen stuff with iOS 9, that's going to bring additional functionality to a larger form factor. But to me, you know, I like my iPad Air. I like the size of that. The 9.7 inch display seems to be perfect for me. So 13 inch, I'm thinking about, you know, MacBook Air size screen without the keyboard. That seems like it might get a little bit cumbersome. So someone's really going to have to prove the use case to me before I get super excited about it. But still, it seems like it is coming. Apple has reportedly asked their suppliers to start ramping up production in September and has Foxconn lined up to do the assembly. So looking at that time frame, if they're starting to put them together around the September time frame, a lot of people are thinking November is when they will hit the streets. We have heard reports that initial order amounts could be very conservative for Apple. So even Apple maybe not so sure that this is going to be a really huge hit, or at least understanding that it's probably a very niche market that they're going to be going into. But early November, late October, which would be a typical time frame for release, because as I mentioned earlier, Apple typically has their October event to announce new products, which usually include new iPads. The question will be, is the iPad Pro going to be the only update to the iPad lineup? And an interesting report came out of Mac Otakara. They reported on a piece from the Economic Daily News out of China that claimed Apple wants the iPad Pro to be the focus of this year's iPad announcements. And to that effect, they're saying Apple might not actually update the iPad Air line, which is shocking. They do claim that the iPad Mini would get a fourth rev, so we get a version 4 of the iPad Mini, but they also say that that could be the last time that Apple updates the iPad Mini model, that Apple may be looking to actually phase that out in the coming years. As far as what the iPad Mini is expected to have, it would be updated internals, things like a new A8 processor, again bringing it up to speed with the Wi-Fi, 802.11 AC Wi-Fi support, and a back case that would be shaped a little bit more like the iPad Air, so have a little bit more of that rounding. Now, I will tell you that this, you know, report out of the Economic Daily News, I think, is sketchy at best. They have a very spotty record on Apple rumors, and I can't imagine that Apple is not planning to bring us an iPad Air 3. The only thing really supporting the Economic Daily News thing is that to date, we have not really heard any other rumors with respect to the iPad Air getting an update. So we haven't seen parts leaks or case leaks or any of these sorts of things that we typically see and have been seeing for, say, like the iPad Pro. But we also haven't seen anything really related to an update to the iPad Mini that I can think of. So it maybe isn't that unusual, because these are going to be kind of smaller incremental updates. And we're just going to have to wait and see. But I would put my money that we're going to get the iPad Pro, updates to the iPad Mini, and the iPad Air this year. Again, specifically just based on what we saw with some of the split screen and additional keyboard stuff that Apple announced with iOS 9. Those seem prime and ripe for an updated iPad Air model. So I think it's going to happen. What do you think? Shoot me some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. And then finally, in the news for this week, good news for those of you in the UK. Apple Pay has finally hit. It has support from 250,000 retailers and 8 of your major banks: American Express, Nationwide, NatWest, Royal Bank of Scotland, Santander, and Ulster Bank. Hopefully I haven't mutilated the names of those institutions. They were among the first participating financial institutions. There was also supposed to be in there First Direct and HSBC, but at the last minute, they were moved into the coming soon category. Although quickly after Apple Pay launched in the UK, First Direct came out and confirmed on Twitter that they would have Apple Pay. They're saying it's going to be available later in July. HSBC also tweeted out saying they're going to launch Apple Pay at the end of this month. And actually, a spokesperson for HSBC spoke to Apple Insider, or gave a statement to Apple Insider rather, and said that they would be launching in 2 weeks. So if your bank happens to be one of those two, just hang in there. You're going to get Apple Pay hopefully before the end of the month. And then Barclays, they were still the major bank, I think, that was missing. And they have representatives quoted as saying that Apple Pay functionality would be available imminently. They didn't give a hard date, although they did come out later and tweet on their account that they promised support for Apple Pay on their cards in the future. No knowing when in the future is actually going to be. And I think that has shocked a couple of you in the UK, because I've heard from a few people saying that they're really disappointed Barclays wasn't on board day one. The Telegraph is also reporting that future bank support should come in from Halifax, Lloyds, and Bank of Scotland. That's due to hit this fall. Although I'm looking at my notes and now noting that I said Royal Bank of Scotland was available at launch. So maybe I'm a little confused on that one. And if you happen to know the clarification, look that over. But also retailers who are on board: Boots, Waitrose, Pret, Transportation for London, KFC, and McDonald's. They're all offering initial retail support for Apple Pay. So if you're looking for a place to go test it out, try one of those locations. I'm sure there's more with 250,000, you know, sort of retailers on board. And a few of people have, you know, noted that their local favorite restaurant or little shop is actually taking Apple Pay. And few of you have had an opportunity to try it out. And from what I've been hearing, it's going pretty smoothly for those places that are actually supporting it. just like the launch here in the US, I think the difficulty is finding someone to actually take Apple Pay. And a lot of times retailers don't even know that they're accepting Apple Pay. You just kind of have to try it out with the system and see what happens. In the UK, as we've been talking about, the system does fall under their current NFC limits. So there is a £20 limit on contactless payment transactions in the UK right now, and that includes Apple Pay transactions. That limit is going to be raised to £30, though, in September. And then back here in the US, we did get a little bit of Apple Pay news of our own. Chevron, the gas station, announced that they are finally taking Apple Pay at a pump. And yes, I did say a pump, not many pumps. Chevron was announced as an original Apple Pay partner, but their Apple payment system has been MIA at most of their service stations. They now have one gas station in San Ramon, California. They're doing a test. They claim there's going to be more locations soon, although they gave no timeline and no promises, but they did tweet out that it would be in Cupertino soon. So hopefully that will happen in the next week or two. But wow, yeah. Why it's taking so long for them to roll that out, I'm not really sure. Although they are the only, I think, gas oil partner for Apple Pay that has been announced. Oh, and I forgot to mention another thing on Apple Pay in the UK. If you do plan to use it on transit for London, they are telling customers to make sure that they have a full charge on their Apple Watch or iPhone, specifically before using the underground, because if you get to your destination and can't touch out, which I think means this is the way the system works, is you touch in, you use Apple Pay to get in at one station, and then it determines what to charge you when you go out, right? You touch again to go through the terminal, and then that determines, okay, you went from point A to point B. The rate for that is this much, and that's how much you get charged. Well, if you get on the underground and then your battery on your iPhone dies and you can't use Apple Pay on the other end, you're going to get charged the full fare. So you're going to get charged the full amount. So if you don't want that to happen to you, make sure that you're fully charged up before you get on. And don't think that you can charge, in the station or on the train along the way, because also this week, a man who was charging his device on the London Overground was picked up and detained for suspicion of abstracting electricity. I guess they frown on that. There's some sockets that are on the train, and those are reserved exclusively for cleaning staff. You're not allowed to charge your devices on those, apparently. And he got in a little bit of trouble for it. So don't think that you're going to be able to charge up before you have to get off at your stop. Make sure you're charged up all the way. But other than that, very little issues on Apple Pay launch in the UK, and it's great that you guys are getting it. I'm hoping Apple's going to roll out Apple Pay to many more countries a little bit more quickly than they got it out into the UK, because it's an awesome system and I think everybody should have it. So getting a lot of great feedback. If you want to give me more feedback about your Apple Pay experiences in the UK, shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. But with that is going to do it for the news for this week. Want to talk a little bit about Apple Music and iTunes Match. We discussed some of the differences regarding the DRM and that sort of stuff last week. But this week, something else that was confusing popped up. Kevin noticed that on his iOS devices in the settings music area, there is now no option to turn on or off iTunes Music Match. So we talked about the fact that Apple has said iTunes Music Match is a complementary service to Apple Music. And really the thing is that if you want to put your library up in the iCloud Music Library, and you want to be able to pull it back down in the Apple Music format that you're, excuse me, I'm going to confuse everybody. In the format that's not the Apple Music format, so the un-DRM format, then that's when you want to keep your iTunes Music Match subscription. Because if you're just going to rely on Apple Music, which has similar functionality to iTunes Music Match, with Apple Music, everything that you pull down from the iCloud music library is going to have DRM applied to it. So they really are complementary services. The problem, though, that Kevin was having was that after upgrading to iOS 8.4 and iTunes 12.2, there didn't appear to be an option to turn on or off iTunes Music Match on his devices. And I did a little looking around and investigating, and it turns out that it looks like what happened is Apple changed the semantics a little bit. So it was there in iTunes, or it was there in iOS 8.3, right? The iTunes Music Match. So if you went into settings, into music, you could turn on or off iTunes Match. Now in 8.4, the option says iCloud Music Library, which is the thing that holds your My Music tracks for Apple Music. And the iCloud Music Library, when Apple Music dropped, seemed to be something that was related to just Apple Music. I think that's really not the case. I think actually iCloud Music Library existed as part of iTunes Match. It just wasn't really promoted that way. It seemed like iTunes Match was the thing. So I think what is going on here now is Apple has made this clearer line between its music services, Apple Music and iTunes Music Match, and the syncing and storing repository, the iCloud storage part of it, which is simply referred to as iCloud Music Library. And the iCloud Music Library actually serves both Apple Music and iTunes Music Match, as near as I can tell. So basically, I think what happens now is iCloud Music Library is the thing that contains cloud versions of all of your music if you're using these services, regardless of which service you're subscribed to or what the source of that music was. So just like you have your local iTunes music library, right? And that thing has all of your music in it, whether it was something that you ripped or you purchased, or something that was matched with iTunes Music Match, or it was something that you downloaded from Apple Music. It's all mixed and mingled into your iTunes music library, and that's your local library. Now you have also your iCloud music library, and it's the same thing. All of that stuff is mixed and mingled together in that library in the cloud, and then that thing is synced over to your Mac and your iOS devices and in the cloud. So it kind of, when you think about it, it does make sense that Apple changed that semantic, but it certainly can be a little bit confusing if you're using iTunes Music Match and you're trying to turn it on or off on your iOS device. And you go in there and it says iCloud Music Library. So just wanted to point that out because I had not noticed that. Kevin noticed it, and I would have been very confused the first time I went in there as well. So hopefully that clears that up for anybody who is using, one or the other service, or even both of them. So Apple Music, iTunes Music Match are the services. iCloud Music Library is the storage repository for all the music. For both of those services. David emailed me to say he's thinking of moving from Android to iOS when the iPhone 6S comes out. And David, I have to say, I think I totally agree with your decision. I think it's a very smart and wise decision to make. Welcome to the year. I guess I'm being a little bit premature, but I'll now pre-welcome you to the iOS community. But David is asking our advice and help with the migration. He's wondering about, how does the process go? What are some of our tips and tricks for actually making the transition from Android to iOS? He also had some specific questions, actually specifically about how do you deal with unzipping files on iOS when you don't have a computer involved. And David, a couple of things I'll mention to you. Apple, with the release of iOS 8.4, has actually made it very easy and nice and convenient for folks like you to move from Android to iOS. They added a new application that you can get called Move to iOS. And what's really cool about it is it will actually take the data from your Android devices in terms of, say, your contacts and I think your emails and all that sort of stuff, and help you move it over to your iOS device. It actually sort of automates that process of bringing all that stuff over. And it can do that for almost everything. The only thing that it can't move over is, I believe, like DRM'd media content. So if you have TV shows or movies, those sorts of things. And then any purchased applications that you have on Android, you're actually going to have to repurchase over on the iOS side. But even with apps, the move to iOS app does something pretty clever. For any free applications that you have on your Android device, if that same application is available for free in the iOS store, it will actually migrate that over for you. For things that are paid, again, where it can find the same app in the App Store, it will actually set up and create a wish list for you. And you can use that to then go through and rebuy all of your applications very easily. So you don't have to go sort of hunt all that stuff down and make big lists and things for yourself. So Apple's tried to make it very easy for you to actually migrate. Another bit of advice I could give you is if you don't want to do it yourself, you may want to go into the Apple Store, you know, set up a Genius Bar appointment at your local Apple Store, and I'm sure they would help you out with that migration. But yeah, it should be a pretty straightforward process. David also asked about, as I said, unzipping files. How do you unzip files without a computer? Well, David, good news is the mail and messages applications were updated a few generations back, I think, to actually automatically decompress zip files. So if the way you're getting those documents is through mail or messages, it really shouldn't be an issue. And then once they're sort of unzipped, you can, of course, open them up in other applications and move them and deal with them however you want. If you're getting the files some other way, there are a bunch of good third-party document and file management apps that actually can do the zipping and unzipping. I think Documents by Readle will do it. Also, I like to use GoodReader or Transmit from Panic. All of those can actually handle and manage zipping and unzipping files. So there's certainly a bunch of ways to go. There's also many, many, if you search the App Store, many, many dedicated just zipping and unzipping apps if you want to go that route. So what would happen is you get the app in, or you get the file in zip format, and you just use the share button and do the open with option. And I would imagine at this point there maybe even is certain apps that have an extension that would allow you to zip or unzip files. I haven't specifically gone looking for those, but if you happen to know one of those, shoot me an email, let me know about it, mattcast@gmail.com. Or if you have some sort of clever way for handling zip files on iOS that I'm not thinking of, share a tip with us, and I'd be happy to share that on a future episode. As for other advice, David, you know, I haven't personally ever done that transition. I've never been an Android user. I did have an Android phone that I played around with, but I was never really a user of Android. So I didn't have all my contacts and information and stuff in there. So I'm not really sure sort of other tips and tricks. So if you are an Android to iOS switcher and you've gone through the process and you have some advice for David, it'd be great if you could send me an email or an audio comment related to that. And maybe we can help you out, David, with this transition. Maybe we'll even encourage you to make it a little bit sooner. Although I'm sort of with you. If you already have an Android device that you're happy with, I would wait until Apple announces the new models and then make the transition over then. So the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus are looking to be some pretty impressive devices. If you haven't heard the last episode of the MacCast, we talked about some of the specs. Specifically, I'm most excited about some of the rumors we're hearing related to the camera system and the updated camera components. I think they're going to be, I mean, the iPhone is already an amazing camera. It's only going to get leaps and bounds better, it sounds like, with the next version of the iPhone. So again, early welcome to the iOS world. And obviously you're a MacCast listener, so you've been a part of the community for a while. And welcome here as well. So thanks for your email. And hopefully there's a few tips there to help you out. One really cool feature that Apple added to Mail as part of OS X Yosemite was a feature called Mail Drop. And this was specifically set up and designed to deal with the issue of sending large email attachments. I think anybody who's dealt with email for any period of time knows the problem when you're trying to send a bunch of attachments and they get too big, either for the sending server or the receive server, right? There's an attachment size limit for a lot of mail servers. And when you hit this, your email gets bounced back with a message saying, you know, some sort of size violation, or your attachments were too big, I couldn't send it. And it's really annoying because a lot of people use email to, you know, move files back and forth. And as images and things get larger and larger, it's getting more and more difficult to send these attachments back and forth. And so what MailDrop did, if you had an attachment that was too big for mail to handle, Apple Mail would automatically in the background just say, okay, I'm going to take this file, I'm going to put it up into iCloud. I'm going to use iCloud storage. And I think this is storage even outside of your normal iCloud limit. Don't quote me on that because I can't remember, but I think. But regardless, it's going to take the attachment, it's going to put it up into iCloud storage, and then send off your email. And then what's really cool is on the receiving side, if the person is using OS X Mail in Yosemite, they just get the attachment in their email like it's totally normal, like nothing's happened. But really, it kind of does this, you know, three-way trip. It goes up into iCloud, the email gets sent, you know, it's sort of this triangular pattern. Email gets sent and then received. And then on the receiving end, it notices, oh, hey, this has an attachment. And oh, by the way, it's up in iCloud. Just pull this down and, you know, attach it to the email. So it sort of bypasses the email system and goes through iCloud. Now, if the person is not on Yosemite and not using Apple Mail, it simply just sends them a link and then they can click on the link in the email to directly download the attachment from iCloud. And I haven't actually had a need to use this feature, but I've talked to people and I know people who've used it and they absolutely love it. And I received an email this week from a listener who's been using the feature but discovered a little problem with MailDrop, because MailDrop sets an arbitrary minimum size threshold for when it actually kicks in and starts to use that feature. And that threshold is a 20 megabyte attachment. So you have to have at least a 20 megabyte attachment before MailDrop will kick in and do its thing. And this particular listener had a lower requirement. He had a server that was bouncing back an email attachment that was just 15 megabytes. And so, and I've even seen as low as 2 to 5 megabytes. So the question became, you know, is there a way to adjust that minimum threshold to actually force MailDrop to kick in for lower sized attachments? And I did some searching around and a little bit of research, and there was no official setting in Mail. So it's not like you can go into the Mail preferences and tweak that setting. But the site OS X Daily actually had a helpful article that had a terminal hack in it. So there is a little terminal command that you can plug into the terminal and adjust that size limit. You basically set the min size KB is the value. And it's your typical default, you know, write com.apple.mail command. And I'll have that in the show notes at maccast.com. And then you basically pass in a number, and the number is in kilobytes. So the size in kilobytes. So 10,000 kilobytes would be a 10 megabyte file. And if you change the setting, then at that point, from that point forward, anytime you have attachments that are 10 megabytes or larger, MailDrop will kick in and do its thing. So you can set it as low or as high as you want and tweak it till you're to your heart's content. And if you ever need to change it back, just adjust the minimum, you know, kilobyte size value back up to the default, which is 20. So that'd be 20,000, right? So you can actually tweak it. And I thought that was pretty interesting. So I hope that helps out. Of course, another way that you could handle attachments is you could do the same sort of thing on your own, right? You can use one of the myriad of other cloud-based file services that give you free accounts. So I've used Dropbox for this. You could use Google Drive, OneDrive, Box. I mean, you name the service. There's lots of options for this. There's also been, you know, different services for just handling mail attachments, some of these like drop services and stuff like that. But the thing is that's just not as cool as having it built right in and seamless in the mail application. So, you know, I'd prefer to use MailDrop because it's just you attach the attachment just like you normally would, and it's sort of magically handled. And that's really the Apple way, isn't it? So really cool feature. And, you know, it'd be nice if Apple would actually give a setting to tweak this, but there you go. You can do a little terminal hacking, and it's not too scary. It's pretty easy to do. So check that out. Again, I'll have the full details in the show notes at maccast.com. And then I want to talk a little bit about Apple Music and just tell you, from the moment I started using it, I absolutely loved it. And I had not had this experience with some of the other streaming services that I tried. You know, I've tried out Spotify. It's great. I've used Pandora. It's great. They're nice services. Nothing wrong with them. This isn't a knock on them. But Apple Music, from the first moment I started using it, it just sort of clicked to me. And I even tried Beats. And I know Apple Music is very similar, has some similar aspects to Beats. But I'm just blown away. I think Apple has done a really good job. And I think a big part of it is, and I think I talked about this on the last episode, is the integration, right? The fact that all my music is in now in one place. And I don't really have to worry about where it came from, whether it was purchased or matched or part of Apple Music. It's just all in one library. But another thing that's really made me like Apple Music has happened a little bit more slowly. It's happened over, you know, the weeks that I've been actually using it. And what it is that as I'm listening, it's getting better and better. And, you know, I think one of the reasons it's really good, of course, is the human curation that they put into playlists and radio stations. They're put together by humans and experts, and they make sure that they have the right songs in the right order and the right places, and that they're the right kind, and they make sense to be together. And, you know, the playlists are really, really good. But the other thing that's making it a lot better is the ability to actually train and massage and get Apple Music to really know your music tastes and really tailor it to match you. And it all starts the first time that you launch Apple Music, right, with the little bubble interface, the onboarding process, whatever you want to call it, right? It gives you a bunch of genres and it says, okay, which of these genres do you like? Here's these little bubbles, and you tap once if you like it, and you tap twice if you like it even more, and the bubble grows and it gets even bigger. And if it's a genre you don't like, you tap and hold on it until it pops, right? You pop it and say, you know, I don't like country music, which is true for me, so I popped that bubble, right? So you pick all the genres, and then it throws you in and asks you to select some artists, some of your favorite artists that you like. And again, same sort of process. Tap once for I like them, kind of. Tap twice, yeah, I really, really like these guys, and pop the ones that you don't like. And then you can even request additional artists. And a lot of people don't know this, and I would encourage you to pay attention to that. You know, make sure you pop the artists that you don't like. Don't accept one that's sort of like, I like them a teeny tiny bit, right? Actually find the artists that you really like and make sure those are the ones that you're picking and adding into it. And if you've already gone through this process, it sort of sets up this base profile of the kinds of music that you like. And if you're hearing me talk about this now and going, I probably didn't really tweak it right the first time around, you can actually reset it. It's pretty easy to do. Just go into the For You section of Apple Music and then tap on the little profile icon. That's the one with the little silhouette of a head. And then there's an option in there that says Choose Artists for You. And tap on that and you can go back through that whole bubble process and sort of redo it and tweak it. So if you've been finding that the recommendations and some of the For You stuff isn't really matching for you, you might want to go back through and try retraining it and make sure that you, you know, get rid of artists you really don't like and really find the ones that you really, really do. But then after that, once you're there, then you just start listening, right? You do the normal thing. You use Apple Music, and there's a bunch of tools and stuff in there to kind of help further train and further massage and make it even more personalized to you. So you have the For You section. And that's really the recommendations that are going to be based on the selections that you've made. So first, the bubble selections, but then additional selections that you make as you're listening to music. And we're going to talk more about those in a minute. Then you have the new section. That's all the new stuff and the charts. You know, I found great trending stuff in there, so I can look at, you know, sort of the top songs, and I found things in there through just sort of natural discovery. But it, that section is not tailored for your preferences. So just so you know, when you're going into the new section, it's not going to be specifically new stuff for you. It's just kind of the general new stuff. Although I would encourage you to scroll down to the playlist section, which is buried a little bit. I wish it wasn't buried, but scroll down and they have Apple Editor playlists, which are sorted by genres and things like that. They have activity playlists. So, you know, hey, I've got a barbecue going on, or I'm doing a dinner party, or, you know, those sorts of things. And they also have curator playlists, which are done by some of Apple's partners. They have like Pitchfork Magazine, Wired, Pop Crush, Decibel Magazine. So music publications, tech publications, I think Vogue's in there as well. And they let those people kind of put together playlists. And a lot of those are really, really good. And I like the fact that they have pretty good descriptions and titles, and you can kind of figure out the ones that you're going to like. It's a great way to kind of discover some music, maybe if you're not really sure what you want to look for. And then another way is for discovery is, you know, the radio stations. Again, they're not specifically to your tastes, but you can browse through the various genre stations. So you can at least start with a genre that you like. Or better yet, you can actually create a station on your own from an artist, a song, or an album that you find and like on Apple Music. And to make a station, all you have to do is tap on the little dot, dot, dot in the now playing section on something you like, and you can choose start station, and it will start station from that track. And those appear in the recently played section of Apple Music, so you can go back in there later and listen to those stations. But really the key to Apple Music is the key to your hearts, or your heart. I know it's a bad pun. I had to do it, right? But using the little hearts, which is really the like button now in Apple Music. So if you found something, you're listening to a radio station or a playlist, or you're listening to Beats One Radio, and you really hear something that you like, I would encourage you, use that little heart. It's not like other, specifically in the radio section, it's not like other services where that is going to tweak and massage and change your radio station. So a lot of us are even used to the whole radio stations that we had in iTunes Match, where you would say, you know, I really like this artist, or I don't like this artist, and it would massage and change that station. That's not going to happen. You can feel a little bit more comfortable with sort of tapping the hearts and liking stuff in Apple Music, because it's really the secret sauce to getting the For You section to be massaged and really made for you. It adjusts those original picks and further fine tunes based on your listening behavior and the stuff that you're saying, yeah, I really, really like this. I will just caution, you know, again, be careful. Make sure you're liking stuff that you really like, because if you like the wrong thing, it can throw off some of those recommendations. And this happened to me. I don't know what I did, but I tapped on something and suddenly in the For You section, I was getting a lot of country playlists. And that's probably my least favorite genre of music. I'm not a huge country music fan, and suddenly I was getting these playlists. But even if that happens to you, don't worry about that, because there actually is a way to dislike some of the recommendations that the For You section is making to you. So if you actually tap and hold on a For You playlist, you'll get a little pop-up, and there's a I don't like this suggestion option. So you can tap on that and tell Apple, you know what? I appreciate you tried to make me a playlist that I might like, but no, that's really not, you know, those songs are not anything that I really like. So you can tell them that too. And so basically you can tell Apple Music all these preferences, and you can combine that with this human curation, and you get some pretty awesome, you get a pretty awesome music experience. Can you tell I'm excited about it? I've been really enjoying it. I listen to Apple Music now every day, and I go to all the different areas. I'll go to the new section to check out what's new. I'll listen to a little bit of Beats 1. I'll throw stuff into a playlist. I'll go back over to the For You section and find something to listen to there. And I've discovered already more new music than I probably have in the past year using some of the other services and just talking to people and stuff like that. So I think it's great. I'd love to hear your experiences with Apple Music and what you're thinking about it, good, bad, or indifferent. You don't have to be in the same camp as I am. If you totally hate it and you prefer some other service, let us know. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Going to finish up today with my thing of the moment. This is another one. You know, I wish sometimes people would come up with more creative product names. This is the Anker 40-watt, 5-port, family-sized desktop USB charger. I know, just makes you want to run out and buy it, right? No, but you do want to run out and buy this thing because it is awesome. If you're like me, you've got a bunch of the little sort of Apple wall chargers, you know, for charging up your iOS devices. And it's one port, and they're the little brick things. And as coolly designed as they are, I know they look great because they're Apple designed things. But I'm constantly having to run around and try and find the right one, right? Because I've got some iPod ones, I've got some 5-watt ones, and 10-watt ones, and 12-watt ones. It's like, what one do I need for the device that I'm trying to plug in and charge? It's a pain in the rear. And I have third-party ones, and it's the same sort of thing, right? And they have one port or multiple ports, but then you look at it, it's like it doesn't have enough wattage or it doesn't have enough amperage. Don't deal with that. Get this Anker thing. It's a 5-port USB wall charger, but it has smart ports. It's intelligent. It knows what it's doing. I actually got mine as a gift off of my Amazon wish list from a listener. Thank you, thank you, thank you. You know who you are. It's awesome. It's because I hate digging around to find the right wall charger. And you want to get the fastest charge. If you're going to be plugging into the wall, you want to make sure that you're getting the full amperage, full fastest charge, right? So this Anker one has something they call Power IQ amp adjustment technology. So it's going to detect what the device needs for the fastest charging and deliver that regardless of what port you plug it into on this 5-port hub. So it has a total of 40 watts and 8 amps. It can handle all of your devices, no problem, at full charging speed, or most of them. I probably don't want to get myself in trouble with the absolutes there, but you get the idea. It's UL certified, so you know it's safe. And it's about the size of a deck of cards, so it's not too big. It's portable. You can throw it in your bag if you're traveling. It does have an external power cord with a standard plug, and I actually like that. So it has a lead, so you can, you know, extend it out, and you can plug it in, and it's not going to block the whole outlet. That's another problem with Apple's little, you know, wall chargers, is they tend to block the outlet. About the only bad thing that I've noticed about it is that for some reason it does state that it doesn't support charging of the iPod Nano or the iPod Classic and some GPS or Bluetooth devices. I'm not really sure why that is, but it is on the packaging, so I just want to throw that out there. But this thing is awesome. It's $26 US on Amazon, so it's totally a great price. Absolutely love it. The Anker, and that's A-N-K-E-R, the Anker 40-watt 5-port family-sized desktop USB charger. Check it out. And again, I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to find it. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices, along with PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can find more information and details on all of their great software over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And Tunnelbear is a really simple VPN app to browse privately and get around blocked websites. You can try it today by going to tunnelbear.com/maccast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. They're at CacheFly.com, and all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. You can find them at BackbeatMedia.com. If you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to MacCast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9, or leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype username is TheMacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you're on the social medias, on the internets, on the Twitters, the Facebookies, the Google Plusy thingy hangouts, whatever it might be, you can find me there. On Twitter, it's MacCast. Also, Facebook page is facebook.com/TheMacCast. And you can check out the Google Plus community. That's at google.com/the+MacCast. So should be able to easily find me online between shows. I look forward to seeing you there. But until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.